This podcast is a part of the Carbon Almanac Network of Podcasts.
Hi, I'm Christina. I'm from Prague.
Hi, I'm Jen, and I'm from Canada.
Hi, I'm Olabanji, and I'm from Nigeria.
Hello, I'm Liki, and I live in Paris.
Hi, I'm Brian, and I'm from New York.
Welcome to Carbon Sessions, a podcast with carbon conversations for every day with everyone from everywhere in the world. In our conversations, we share ideas, perspectives, questions, and things we can actually do to make a difference. So don't be shy and join our Carbon Sessions because it's not too late.
Hi, it's Liki, and welcome to today's episode of Carbon Sessions. Today, we're bringing you a special rebroadcast from Talaterra, a podcast hosted by Tania Marin, a member of the Carbon Almanac Network. Tania is an independent environmental education professional. And in this episode, she speaks with Sarah Johnson about her observer experience at the COP Climate Conference in Glasgow. For those who wonder, COP stands for Conference of the Parties, which is an annual global summit where world leaders, scientists, and activists come together under the United Nations to negotiate and review policies regarding climate change. Sarah attended COP26 in the capacity of an observer, and unlike negotiators who actively participate in crafting and agreeing to policy decisions, observers monitor and report on the proceedings. They provide transparency, gather insights, and share information with the broader public. But observers do not engage in the negotiation processes themselves. Sarah's reflection from the event are filled with excitement, awe, and humility, offering a blend of diverse worldviews and rich human experiences. She underscores the complexity of climate discussions, reminding us that they are rarely simple answers. Sarah also highlights the impactful role of art and storytelling in spreading the message of climate urgency and climate justice. So let's tune in.
Welcome to Talaterra, a podcast about freelance educators working in natural resource fields and environmental education. Who are these educators? What do they do? Join me, and let's find out together. This is your host, Tanya Marion. Today, my guest is Sarah Johnson. Sarah is a freelance science educator whose specialty areas are climate change, public lands, watershed science, civics, geography, and teaching and learning. Sarah leads educator professional development workshops, teaches public lands courses, teaches programs for the International Arctic Buoy Program, and leads a Colorado cohort of climate change educators. Sarah's created and facilitated many environmental education programs, including the award-winning Youth Water Leadership Program. In November 2021, Sarah had the opportunity to attend the United Nations Climate Change Conference of the Parties, usually referred to as COP26. In this episode, Sarah takes us to Scotland and shares her experience at this event. Thank you, Sarah, for stopping by to be on the show and to share your experience in Glasgow with us at COP26.
It's wonderful to be here with you. Thanks for the invitation.
From what I've read in the summary, or from the UN's summary about the climate change conference in Glasgow, there were 40,000 registered participants. And that of those 40,000, there were 14,000 or more than 14,000 observers there. And you were there as an observer. And so I was wondering, how were you able to participate in that capacity at that landmark event? And so if you could explain what the observers did or were able to do and how you were able to join in that way.
It all comes down to relationships. I have been working with an organization in Minnesota called Climate Generation that many folks are familiar with. Climate Generation is a lead climate education organization, not only in the Northern Midwest, but now I would say all over the country. And they host a summer institute for education, for climate change education. And educators, both formal and non-formal educators, are encouraged to participate. And because it has gone virtual since 2020, they needed regional cohort leaders for different regions of the country. And they called me and said, would you like to be a regional cohort leader in the summer of 2020? And no one knew what that exactly meant or how that was going to play out. And I said, sure, let's figure it out together. Before that, I had made relationships with leading climate change education professionals across the country through conferences and other professional networks. And they knew about me. And so then I've grown those relationships. And in September, I was reaching out to colleagues and mentors, just checking in on the playing field of environmental education. Like, where are we and where are we headed? And what shall I do next? And somebody said, from Climate Generation, said, you should come to Glasgow with us. And I was like, really? And so they know of there's a charter high school outside of the Twin Cities that has typically taken students to United Nations climate meetings in the past. And because of COVID, those students were unable to travel this year. And so in this last minute time frame, they were looking for educators to take their places. The administration was passing those observer badges forward. And so anyway, long story short is that I was offered one of those badges along with a few other really awesome educators from around the country. And we went as a civil society or observers, as you said. And so in addition to the relationships specifically with Climate Generation, I also am part of something called the U.S. ACE Coalition. And ACE stands for the Action for Climate Empowerment Coalition. And many people, including you who are listening to this podcast, probably are doing the work of ACE and probably should join the ACE Coalition. It's everyone's welcome. And the work of the ACE Coalition is to be advocates for six big buckets of empowerment around climate change. And those big buckets are education, training, public awareness, access to information, public participation, international collaboration, and then all of that through a lens of climate justice. And the Action for Climate Empowerment language is actually United Nations language, and it's something bigger than the United States. And we are all around the world encouraged or directed by the United Nations to be finding ways to put this idea into action within all of our climate policy work and all climate work of all kinds. And it's a people-centered focus for climate change work. And so there was a whole group of us who were part of the U.S. ACE Coalition, and we were, not all of that coalition was able to attend, but a large handful of us from America were, and I was there, and I was part of press conferences and media blitzes and all kinds of different things that were all around supporting the ACE framework or the ACE, the Action for Climate Empowerment, within the larger negotiations.
That just sounds wonderful. So exciting. So you find out that you have a badge that you can use and that you have the opportunity to go to Glasgow. And how much notice did you have?
I found out 2.5 weeks before I flew away that I was going to get to go to Scotland. And so nothing like traveling during a global pandemic, let alone to a global meeting of people from all around the world, and all within a very short time frame to have international travel set up. And so it was all consuming. And thankfully, I mean, the only reason I was able to say yes is because I did have that flexibility as an independent person, as an independent business. I didn't have to ask the committee for permission. I didn't have to do much. I did sit on it, I think, for maybe 24 hours. It may have been more like 18 hours before I said absolutely yes, because I was so excited. But I pulled all of it together between United Airlines, the United Nations, and the United Kingdom. It was quite challenging. And like I said, it was all consuming before I went. And in addition to the logistics of getting there, it was also the storytelling and the people in my community wanting to know that I was going, and then being able to be available for PR and press and media things, so that story could be told to the people here in rural Colorado through our local community radio station and our newspapers and my own media outlets of all the social media and websites and emails, and really leveraging this opportunity as from a professional development perspective, but also from a credibility development perspective. I have a lot of credibility, but it just was such an opportunity to really keep Wild Rose Education on the map myself on the map as well. And so it was navigating all of those pieces, as well as trying to figure out what in the world my role was in supporting the U.S. ACE Coalition, and understanding, kind of getting brought up to speed on all those details, and then dealing with COVID and lodging and food. And the food wasn't that complicated. It was the lodging and just all the logistics of travel.
How did you resolve the lodging issue on such short order? Did they already have things set up?
So many people probably have watched in the news or heard throughout media that Glasgow lodging became outrageously expensive. And basically the people there were gouging the people coming to the COP26. But then there was this like fringe organization that got set up called the COP26 Coalition. And they did all kinds of stuff outside of the formal conference of the parties, is what COP stands for. And one of the things they did was set up something called the Homestay Network. And they found oodles of people across the city and the surrounding area in Scotland around Glasgow to offer up bedrooms and couches and all kinds of situations. And so I pieced together a couple different homestays. One was with a gentleman and his wife who were super involved in climate justice work through their church. And so it was fascinating to show up and be in their house and then share some stories. And then I had to piece it together. I couldn't find one place for 12 days. And so I also ended up staying at a young couple's house. And one was a PhD student and one was in med school. And again, they were looking for ways to contribute and be part of this massive movement and metropolitan event that was taking over their city. And so this was one way they could do that. And it was really cool because then I got to actually see people from Scotland and from Glasgow. And when you're at a global event, you don't necessarily meet that many people from the place where you are. They're from everywhere else. So that was really nice. And then I also stayed a few nights with a group of colleagues and friends actually from Boulder, Colorado, and they had rented an apartment and they generously offered to share some of their space for a couple nights. So it was a piecemeal thing, but it worked. And I just had very light luggage, so I moved around the city on trains and buses, and I used a lot of public transportation. So that was wonderful. That was available.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you get this spontaneous invitation. You have a badge. You get yourself on a plane. You have accommodations that you put together, and you get to go to COP26. So what did you get to do as an observer? What was a typical day like for you?
I think we have to back up a step and explain that there's basically two different COPs going on. Conference of the Parties, right? There is the very formal actual treaty body that's having negotiations on behalf of our governmental institutions like the United States of America. And then there's this what we might call the Metropolitan Cup, which is all the civil society, all the hoopla, all the energy, all the side meetings, all the protests and marches, and this whole other thing. And so I was part of all of that. I was not part of the governmental treaty body negotiations. That was very, I'm not even sure I knew where that was actually happening. Apparently it was somewhere in this conference facility that was taking over a humongous amount of geographic space. And civil society or observers were not welcome into those spaces. So I don't even know where they were. But in my role as a, it was called an observer, I got to be part of what's called the blue zone. And so also at the COP, there are the blue zone and the green zone. And the blue zone is for people with badges, and the green zone is for more of whoever shows up in the city. And it was held at the Science Museum across the river. And the blue zone is all this conference-like space. And it was like a massive trade show, like the biggest trade show you've ever been to. And instead of like booths at a trade show, they called them pavilions. And each country was invited, or I'm not exactly sure how that came about, but many countries had pavilions in this massive trade show, and as well as constituent groups and other entities like the Nature Conservancy had their own pavilion, as an example. And so within that space, there was a lot of hoopla and never-ending energy. It was constant. I think I figured out that I'd walked 15 miles in a day, according to my step counter on my phone. And so you get up early. I had gone to the grocery store and bought food for breakfast and made simple breakfast, navigated all the transportation. The trains typically took, depending on which place I was staying, it took at least two trains and sometimes a bus to get to the place. And then to get through all this, like, five layers of security between the COVID test. Oh, I forgot. We started at home with COVID testing every single day. And then you had to upload that information onto the National Health Board website. So anyway, there's five levels of security just to get into the conference center. And I don't know if I've never been to an event so big, and social distancing forget that. It was like walking into a place where COVID didn't exist, except that everyone was wearing masks. And a huge percentage of people, like 98% of folks, declared that they had vaccines. And so it felt actually pretty safe from a COVID perspective.
Good afternoon, all COP delegates. We kindly remind you to wear your face mask over your mouth and nose at all times during your time.
And we would wait in line, and in the British vernacular, instead of waiting in line, it's called queuing. I became a professional at queuing for a very long time every day. And so once we were finally in to the blue zone, which sometimes it took from the time I left where I was staying to actually get through the metal detectors and all the way in, was about an hour and a half to 2 hours just to get into the conference. So this was not like any conference you've ever been to where you just come and go and you walk down the street for coffee and then you come back. None of that. It was very humongous. And so in the blue zone, I tried to navigate schedules and figure out who was speaking where. And we had a representation from America of different governmental leaders and legislators and people like Gina McCarthy, and Leonardo DiCaprio was there. I mean, he's not a government. There were speakers happening all the time. You just had to figure out how to navigate about 12 different schedules. And the schedules weren't printed until the night before, typically, and at like 10 o'clock. So exhausting is what it was. And it was like in every direction, and like physically exhausting. It was mentally overwhelming, and emotionally, it was absolutely exhausting, because you'd be trying to keep track of what was actually happening in the actual negotiations, which was very challenging. But then you'd listen, you'd stand in line or queue, be in the queue next to people from all over the world listening. And I just talked to people. I would be like, so where are you from? And then I would ask them like questions of, so how is climate change affecting your family or your town, and the stories I would hear firsthand from people from literally around the world was unbelievably eye-opening. And so there was a lot of that. And then you'd hear of this unbelievable trauma of these communities around climate change impacts. But then you'd turn around and you'd talk to somebody else and it'd be like, it's the most inspiring climate action story you've ever heard. And so it was just kind of a yo-yo of emotions.
What did you become aware of while in Glasgow? I mean, what surprised you that you didn't know? Maybe one thing that surprised you the most. And then if you could then also follow that then with an inspirational story, something that moved you.
I think most surprising thing is that I thought I had a global understanding of climate change. And as someone who is so in that work and so committed to this work and has been for so many years, the ground was pulled out from under me to realize, and I realized that I have so much more learning to do to understand what climate change really means in places all around the world, and understanding this complexity and nuance and so many layers of just so many layers of complexity. And I, like I said, I thought I understood, and I found out that I don't, or that I have a great start. And I think that's probably true for a lot of people. I don't think I'm the only one in that. As far as something that was inspiring, some of the most inspiration that I left Glasgow with is knowing that I had found my people in America. Because of the pandemic, so much of all these relationships that I have grown in the last couple of years have always been pixels on a screen or over the phone. And I'd never actually been able to shake anybody's hand or give them a pat on the back, let alone a hug. And when running around with all these wonderful people who are involved in the U.S. ACE Coalition and getting a chance to build just hallway conversations and all the things that we've been missing during this pandemic, it just filled me up. It filled me up in a way that I was like, wow, I found my people. These people, we're all speaking the same language. We're all here for the same reason. And then we would add to this American group, like these other people from other countries that are also doing the same good work in unique ways for their communities. And it was just, again, it was like, it filled me up with this energy that, wow, there's amazing people out there. And I'm part of that. And I'm doing amazing work where I am. And that was, it's silly to think you have to fly across the Atlantic Ocean to meet your friends from Minneapolis or from upstate New York, but that's what happened. Or I finally made connections with a colleague who's down in Tucson, Arizona, because we were all there. And that was just, it's what happened. And it was really good.
How is the rest of the world dealing with climate change? We have a very much a U.S.-centric viewpoint. And how is the rest of the world doing? What types of stories did you hear?
So the COP26 kind of themes were, there were many of them. A few of them were things around finance and mitigation and adaptation. And there were others. But what's interesting is that the global north, or first world countries that have the least amount of people but the most carbon emissions, are really interested in mitigation and innovation and inventing something else that is going to somehow, natural solutions, things that are kind of future focused. Whereas people from the global south, typically the lower socioeconomic countries with less infrastructure and less money, and who have the most people and the least amount of emissions and are dealing with unbelievable impacts of climate change right now. Whether it's their islands are eroding away, or there's such incredible drought that there are famines, and then there's civil unrest, as well as terrible things happening to women and children, and the list goes on. And these people are telling the global north, we don't have time for mitigation and innovation. We have to deal with adaptation right now. And it's right now. We don't have time. And the global south, what I was hearing over and over is that until the people in the global north, us in America and other very rich countries, until we actually stop consuming so much stuff, they don't want to hear about our innovative ideas. Until we actually reduce the amount of fossil fuels that we are burning each and every day, they're not going to take us very seriously, and they aren't. And that was eye-opening to me. That's a conversation I had never really heard, because I mean, I read probably the same things that the listeners to this podcast are reading. And I listen to news and I pay attention to things. And I thought, I think I have a pretty broad understanding of things, until I understood the global South perspective of natural solutions. And so natural solutions. So if we're going to keep living the way we live, but we're going to plant trees in South America in some village and have this carbon offset kind of thing, or we're going to keep developing and bulldozing here, but then we're going to do something really good in some country in Africa, but we're not even going to really ask the local people in Africa what they need in the whatever country. We're just going to do it because we know that we need to come up with something to make us feel better, but we're not going to actually minimize our consumption here in our very comfortable places that we get to be in America. And so there were hashtag in the marches and even in the blue zone, this whole false solutions, hashtag false solutions, and using words like carbon colonialism were very common. And those are words I had never, ever heard together. And that's not the language that's getting talked about in places like Aspen, Colorado, where I'm down the road from Aspen and other very affluent places. So people are dealing with climate change, I think, is so unique to the place where they are and their worldview and how comfortable they are or not. And it's a very human problem. It's a problem with people and society more than anything else at this point. The earth is going to be okay. It's the people that we have to figure out how to take care of each other a little bit better, or a whole lot better.
And how might we do that?
I think the first step in any of this work is turning a bit inside towards internally into our own hearts and minds, and really doing some soul searching and some soul work to understand who we really are individually, so that we can then be a little bit more empathetic and a little more curious about people who are not like me, people that are different than myself. And then go out of my way and be inconvenienced a little bit to get to know people that aren't like myself and do that work. And our society is not exactly encouraging a lot of we're very homogeneous. We don't have a lot of heterogeneous opportunity to mix up and get to know other people like we maybe used to 30 years ago when there was more civic clubs and things of that nature. And so I think we have to work harder to find people that are not like us. And I don't mean just people of color versus white people. I mean worldviews, different socioeconomics, background difference, immigrant stories that are different, rural, urban, whatever, all the mix of possibility of what could make people's perspective and culture different than mine. And I think once we actually have direct encounters with people that are different than us, it's really hard to unsee that and unsee those stories. And whether those people are from some island in the Maldives in the Indian Ocean, or that person lives across town in my own community, once I have an encounter with them and actually have body language and smiles and shake their hand and hear them and hear their stories, that sticks with you. You can't erase that from your experience. And I think that's what the world needs more of, because then you start to be, because we're humans and humans are innately compassionate and innately take care of each other. I think that's just part of being human. I think we will begin to take care of more people in new ways if we have more true encounters with people. A lot of people have asked me, so was COP successful? Did they make decisions? Are you satisfied with what happened? And I think we might need to reframe that question. And that's the question that's showing up, you know, that showed up in the media left and right. And it's an obvious kind of question. I mean, it's not a judgment on anybody. But I think we might need to reframe that question to consider that how it all happens is that there's this actual treaty body of parties, government entities, government leaders that are negotiating, and they're actually negotiating and having conversations for weeks and months before they ever show up at the COP. And then they continue to have more. And then they hopefully get to some kind of agreement. But it's the whole system is so complicated, and not just the content of climate change and adaptation and mitigation and finance and all the possible solutions and the science and the economics and the never-ending complexity there. Then there's the complexity of just how the United Nations operates and how these different people actually have different titles and different roles and are at different tables for different in different rooms for all these different things. And it's constantly moving. And somehow somebody's keeping track of all that's happening all at the same time. And then there's all of us out in the outside who want answers of what happened and was it successful? And we don't remember that it takes time, maybe 24 hours to actually give these human beings who are only as human as you and I time to digest what just happened where they were, let alone listen to whatever happened in the room next door with their colleagues, to then try to piece it together and figure out how to make sense of it all. And then you might actually be able to follow it all just as easily from a computer in Kansas as you could have if you had been trying to navigate the event center like I was. You might probably had more success following the actual negotiations from a computer than being in the space. And so I think we just have to remember that all of this process is super complicated. And anybody who gives us very quick yes or no, right, wrong kinds of answers, we might want to ask some more questions and say, actually, this might be more complex. Let's dig in a little deeper. Because there is no such thing as a simple answer of was it successful or did they accomplish what they tried to? And so I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind when thinking about these humongous United Nation type gatherings of negotiators and government leaders.
Oh, thank you for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just looked like a really, I mean, it's hard to organize a classroom with 35 students. And so I can't imagine what it's like and all the different customs and cultures and all those things you need to.
And I speak English and I thought it was overwhelming. Yeah.
Okay. So in a review of the study that's called Global Warming's Six Americas, it is a review of the different groups of people and their different perspectives about the subject of climate change, climate science. And so the point that this study makes is that there isn't just one America. There are actually six Americas, six within the country, and that there are people who are in the group which they're calling alarmed. There are people who are concerned, some cautious, some disengaged, some doubtful, and some dismissive. And I'll include a link in the show notes for the online version of this, the online summary. But something that you just said made me think of this one point in this article. In this article, they make a point that Americans have values that they have in common, but they haven't yet connected it to climate change. And that is part of the disconnect between the different groups. There's a wonderful short little video on the website that if you ask, where they make the point where if you ask different groups, different people, what they think about clean energy and reducing pollution and all these types of things, they are in agreement with that. But not everyone has linked it necessarily to this topic, that there is enough a difference of opinion that the communication goes sideways at one point. And so what did you observe when you were in Glasgow? Did you have the opportunity to engage with people who maybe had opposing viewpoints to those who were at the event?
So no, people who came to the COP26 that I encountered were there because they did everything they could to get to a global event that's all about saving the world around climate change. And however, there was a huge delegation of people from the oil and gas industry at the COP26, and that made national news as well. And I think those folks might have been in different meetings than I was. So I did not meet those people directly, or I did not know who they were. I think in the work that we are doing here in the United States with these leaders in climate change education who are part of the environmental education community, we over and over, when the conversation comes up about how do you teach people that don't even believe, it's like, we don't have that conversation. We don't give that conversation much play, because when we look at that Yale study that you're referring to, the Six Americas, if we add all five categories together that are concerned about climate change at some level, it's less than 10% of Americans who don't think this is happening or don't want to believe that it is. And yet they're the loudest. And so there's a silent majority. And I think as environmental educators, we have to remember that. And we have to teach to the majority of people. And the more we even create a space for discussion that isn't it happening, we're backpedaling and we're spinning our wheels and we're not allowing the whole thing to move forward. And so we as environmental educators, I think, need to be spending our time making those connections so that people understand that public health and the incredible numbers of people that are dealing with asthma or not having access to clean drinking water because of all the reasons in these big cities in America, or even rural communities, it's everywhere, that there's relationships between these very real, in-your-face circumstances in your home that are connected to, they're caused by the collective impacts of climate change. And so I think that's where we have a huge opportunity and responsibility as educators, is to draw those connections, because like you said, that's where there's this major disconnect. And a lot of that is fear-based. People don't want to believe in something that is really scary, because it is. And it is scary, or they don't want to accept it. I don't think we can actually talk about this issue as believing or not. I think that's like believing in gravity or something. It's accepting that it's happening and naming it. And I think that's where we have to move forward together as educators, as trainers, as climate empowerment professionals.
So climate education is more than data and economics. It's conversation with your neighbors, right? And with others in your community. How about, it's also a science communication issue. Did you happen to pick up on how people from all different countries do science communication in their communities?
I didn't actually see much of that side of things. I think probably if it had been 10 years ago or even 5 years ago, that probably would have been the central message, was because of the data, climate change is happening. And I think at this point, because the elevated urgency and emergency of climate change, I get a sense that
the focus is on climate justice, and that includes everything from storytelling. Like, I mean, how do we teach climate justice? We teach it through things like storytelling, and we teach it through case studies, and we teach it through using things like deliberative conversations and looking at things from multi-stakeholder perspectives. And we make sure that we're presenting the issue of climate change as a complex, nuanced, complicated thing. And it's not a one side of the table versus another. I don't think debate is a very good tool for teaching because it encourages that somebody's right and somebody's wrong. Whereas I don't think in this work of climate change solutions, there necessarily are always going to be rights and wrongs. There's a whole lot of it depends, and it's nuanced, and it's unique to the place where it is, and it is place-based, right? And so what I'm dealing with right here in my community in the mountains of Colorado is very different than what people are experiencing and dealing with in inner city Los Angeles. And so I think, yes, the science, the process of science is what I think is most important that we as environmental educators are teaching, so that we're teaching the skills of a scientist, we're teaching the skills of how to investigate an issue, both from a stakeholder perspective as well as from a empirical data perspective, and then combining that. But that process of science, that process of asking questions and figuring out what people have done before and what do we know from their research and their experience, and then how do we formulate new questions, and then how do we test those questions, and then how do we ask for more input? and then how do we actually read data and have data literacy, and teaching people data literacy and how to read data in a way that is a critical thinker, and knowing how to ask better questions around data. I think that's the part of science that's really important around when we are teaching about climate change, because then we can apply that to wherever we happen to be or at different scales, the scale of my neighborhood versus the scale of the entire metropolitan area of Seattle. I mean, that's, let alone, you know, the entire bioregion of the Rocky Mountains or whatever it may be. And so being able to have these skills to be able to understand things at different scales is a huge skill that we can be teaching people. And I say people because this is not just about kids. This is about all of us. We all need to be taught and encouraged to improve in these skills of scientific thinking. So I didn't see a whole lot of data. I didn't see a whole lot of graphs. I didn't see a whole lot of the typical climate change graph while I was in Glasgow. I saw artwork. I saw poets. I saw people telling stories through megaphones, people telling stories through sitting together and having conversations. I saw some theater, like stand-up comedy performances. I saw over 100,000 people walking down the streets of Glasgow in the pouring rain. And I was part of that. And that's what I saw.
Sounds like a rich experience. Absolutely. In all levels.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wonderful. Wonderful. What's next for you in terms of Wild Rose education and your climate work and your water work? What's next?
Well, I have been telling the world that I'm more of a climate educator. That's more of the how I describe myself, because that means everything, because everything is a climate issue. I don't know if everybody interprets it that way, but, you know, I plan to continue to be an advocate for climate change education and training and climate empowerment at a community level with this work with the US ACE Coalition, as well as anything and everything that comes with that. But really being an advocate for the opportunity for climate empowerment. So that's one big bucket of things that I'm working on. I'm also committed to continuing to provide and design and facilitate professional development workshops for educators both formal and non-formal educators in so many different capacities through partnering with universities and partnering with the Colorado Alliance for Environmental Education, and really helping to design those programs as well as facilitate them really well. And then I'm also, my third bucket of what it means to be a climate educator is that I'm still very involved with and continue to be very excited about my climate science work that I get to do at the Arctic Ocean. Just this week, I found out that the National Science Foundation has lifted the quarantine rules for Northern Alaska. And so I will be traveling with the International Arctic Buoy Program scientist team in late March up to Utiaghvik, Alaska, which is the northernmost point of the United States, almost the northernmost point of North America. But we'll be spending our time working on environmental sensors on the ocean, on the ice, that measure weather and climate data. And that trajectory, that will continue as long as I want to be involved, it sounds like. So those three big things, climate science, climate education through teacher profession, you know, educator professional development, and then just continuing to be part of the advocacy of around making sure that climate education is even a possibility for people and having access. And so those are my three big buckets in for right now. It's pretty exciting work.
It is exciting. And I'm so excited to hear that your trip to Alaska, you get to, it's still a go because it was abruptly disrupted.
Yeah, it's been, I've been anticipating it for 2 years and I'm a little hesitant to believe it's really going to happen, but I think it might actually happen. And so travel to Utiaghvik, Alaska in late March. And this is all with Polar Trek, which is a program that the National Science Foundation funds to pair educators with science teams. And so 2 years ago, I got selected for that for the Polar Trek program. And then, of course, we've been laying low with COVID. And now we get to go. And then my science team will also go back to the Arctic Ocean in late June, but from the Canadian side of things. And so everybody's welcome and encouraged to follow along this expedition. And you can find the information on my website, but I will also make sure those end up in the show notes as well.
Yes, absolutely. So where can people find you online?
So Wild Rose Education is the name of my business. So wildroseeducation.com is easy to find. And I just recently have updated the website with an Arctic section and a climate change section. So you can see a few things there and maybe be inspired as fellow environmental educators who are listening. I know you are environmental educators, and reach out to me. Like, phone calls are priceless. And maybe we can collaborate on something. And I've been known to have phone calls with people or Zoom calls just because we're not having those coffee meetings at conferences where we just bump into each other in the hallway. And so we have to really intentionally make those opportunities happen. And I'm committed to that. And it takes time, but it's worth it because relationships are what make everything work.
To learn more about Sarah and to explore COP26, Wild Rose Education, and the Polar Trek program more thoroughly, visit the show notes at talaterra.com. Thank you for joining us today. See you next time. Talaterra is a podcast for and about independent educators working in natural resource fields and environmental education. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and colleagues. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Tanya Marion.
You've been listening to Carbon Sessions, a podcast with carbon conversations for every day with everyone from everywhere in the world. We'd love you to join the Carbon Sessions so you too can share your perspectives from wherever you are. This is a great way for our community to learn from your ideas and experiences, connect, and take action. If you want to add your voice to the conversation, go to thecarbonalmanac.org/podcasts and sign up to be part of a future episode. This podcast is also part of the Carbon Almanac Network. For more information, to sign up for the emails, to join the movement, and to order your copy of the Carbon Almanac, go to thecarbonalmanac.org. Be sure to subscribe and join us here again, as together we can change the world.